Hello and welcome to this episode of Epochs, where I shall be continuing my narrative of the decline and fall of the Roman Republic and also the narrative of Caesar's campaigns in Gaul. And we get into the most important bit, or the most interesting bit, the denouement of the piece, almost, when the Gaulic tribes form their last big giant resistance, and Caesar, I hope it's no spoiler alert, Caesar defeats them all. And we're introduced to Vercingetorix. It is the rebellion, book 7, the rebellion of Vercingetorix, the siege of Alesia and all that sort of thing. So let's get straight into it, because it's quite a long chapter. I want to try and get through this whole chapter, this episode, if we can. And then we'll have one more, the final year, 51 BC, where Caesar sort of, and Caesar's captains wrap everything up. And then we can cut straight back to Rome. However, I do need to mention at this point things that have been going on in Rome, because it's been quite a few years since I was last talking about what actually happened in Rome. And there's been all sorts that have gone on. When I go back to that, we will go back in time and talk about everything that happened in Rome since Caesar's left, which is years ago. And there's lots and lots of intrigues and important things, interesting things, with Pompey and Crassus and Cato, and in some of the previous episodes, which hopefully you've watched, you'll know a lot of those. I did episodes on Cato and Crassus already. But at this point, going into the year 52 BC, that's where we're talking about Caesar is in Gaul, 52 BC, what's happened quite recently is the murder of Clodius. Now, I've already gone into that in a bit of detail, but when I cut back to Rome, we'll go into it in full detail. But you need to know about it here because it matters. The death of Clodius, the murder of Clodius, should I say, does turn Rome itself upside down politically. You know, his supporters burned down the Forum, or burned down the Senate House in the Forum, and a few temples and various bits and bobs. And anyway, Rome is turned on its head politically at that point. And it's really important for Caesar and Caesar's career and Caesar's political machinations. And the rumour goes round Gaul that Caesar is going to have to return to Rome to shore up his position, to make sure he's not completely ousted politically, to make sure, you know, all his political enemies don't take advantage of his position too badly, to sort of do away with him, to ruin him politically or legally or financially. Because if you remember, Clodius is one of the leading lights of the Popularis faction, as is Caesar. So Clodius getting murdered is a really big deal, particularly for Caesar's political position. So as I say, the rumour goes around Gaul, and people in Gaul know, you know, they might not be as sophisticated as the Romans in terms of logistics and government and bureaucracy, but they're not stupid. They're absolutely not stupid people. So they hear this and they know what's going on. And they think that not only will Caesar have to return to Rome, but he probably won't come back. He's been in Gaul way longer than any other Roman general has really ever been away. It's unprecedented that he spent so long in Gaul already, and that now he's going to go away. And they see that, they calculate that that's their chance. If they can rise up in one last big giant rebellion, push Caesar out and prevent him from coming back, this is their moment, this is their chance. And that is exactly what they do. And so their new leader is Vercingetorix. Because this chapter is so long, I won't actually read every last word of it, as I've been doing in the last few episodes. I have to give you the York Notes version of some of it, but I will introduce you to Vercingetorix. Caesar tells us there, he means in Gaul, there, the lead given by the Carnutes, that's a tribe, the Carnutes, was followed by Vercingetorix, a very powerful young Arvernian, whose father, Celtillus, had held suzerainty over all Gaul and had been put to death by his compatriots for seeking to make himself king. Assembling his retainers, Vercingetorix had no difficulty in exciting their passions, and the news of what was afoot soon brought others out in arms. And we go on to get quite a few pages of description of how lots of different tribes, it's classic Caesar in Gaul, where he just gives you a list of tribes that join Vercingetorix, and it's lots of them. The Senones, the Parisi, the Caduci, the Turoni, Alerci, Lemovices, Andes, Pictones, and others. So, Vercingetorix raises pretty much a giant army, nearly all of Gaul, in rebellion. And this is still in the winter, in the very early months of 52 BC. It's still snowy and cold. And usually it's the off-season, right? It's not the campaigning season. But once again, Caesar realises that he has to nip this thing in the bud. Once again, he realizes that he needs to take the initiative if he is to stand any chance, because if he waits till spring or even summer, there might be a giant host ranged against him. So in the middle of winter, again, he basically takes to the field and starts doing military manoeuvres and things. And what he does is he marches straight into the territory, Vercingetorix's territory, that part of Gaul, and starts besieging towns, even though it's freezing cold. And he moves across certain mountain ranges, which we're told the Gauls thought were impenetrable, considered them like a brick wall. Just couldn't get over them in winter. Completely impracticable, impassable in winter. But Caesar just does. If his legionaries can build a camp every night, or can build a bridge across the Rhine in a few days, then they can clear snowdrifts, even if they're 6 foot deep. Not a problem. So Caesar starts besieging some towns. A place called Gergobina, Cenabum, Noviodunum, Velodunum, and some others. And Vercingetorix and his coalition immediately sort of realise, obviously they see what Caesar's doing, and they immediately make a sort of strategic decision to retreat and do a scorched earth policy in their own territory, burn down their own towns, and make sure they leave in their wake absolutely no food, no corn, no supplies whatsoever for the Romans. Hoping, calculating almost correctly, that that will sort of stop Caesar in his tracks because it's winter. And we're told that Caesar does have a difficult time of it, and his men go hungry for a long time, and he has to send for cattle from very, very far away to stave off starvation in his own among his own army. But then Vercingetorix and his giant army reached the town of Avaricum, which was a very, very big town. It was not just a small settlement, but it was, well, we're told later that it's one of the most important, biggest cities in France. And the townspeople there say, look, plead with Vercingetorix, please don't burn it down. We can defend it. It's in a really good spot, geographically, tactically, to defend it. And there's marshes all around, and there's all sorts of reasons why there's no point burning it down. We can defend it. And Vercingetorix relents. So I'll pick up the story, or let Caesar, rather, pick up the story with the siege of Avaricum. In, again, we're in 52 BC, so Caesar tells us this, quote, after this series of reverses for the Gauls and Vercingetorix, at Velodunum, Cenabum, and Noviodunum, Vercingetorix summoned his followers to a council of war and told them that their plan of campaign must be completely changed. Now, this is apparently Vercingetorix speaking. He is apparently supposed to have said, we must strive by every means to prevent the Romans from obtaining forage and supplies. This will be easy, since we are strong in cavalry and the season is in our favour. There is no grass to be cut, so the enemy will be forced to send out parties to get hay from the barns, and our cavalry can go out every day and see that not a single one of them returns alive. What is more, when our lives are at stake, we must be prepared to sacrifice our private possessions. Along the enemy's line of march, we must burn all the villages and farms within the radius that their foragers can cover. We ourselves have plenty of supplies, because we can rely on the resources of the people in whose territory the campaign is conducted. But the Romans will either succumb to starvation, or have to expose themselves to serious risk by going far from their camp in search of food. We can either kill them or strip them of their baggage, which will be equally effective, since without it they cannot keep the field. We should also burn all the towns, their own towns, except those which are rendered impregnable by natural and artificial defences, otherwise they may serve as refuges for shirkers among our own numbers, and give the enemy the chance of looting the stores of provisions and other property that they contain. You may think these measures harsh and cruel, but you must admit that it would be a still harsher fate to have our wives and children carried off into slavery and be killed yourselves, which is what will inevitably befall you if we are conquered. And that's the end of his little speech. Caesar himself continues the narrative, saying, this proposal was unanimously approved, and in a single day more than 20 of the Biturges towns were fired. The same was done in the territory of the neighbouring tribes, until fires were visible in every direction. And although this was a grievous sorrow to all Gauls, they found consolation in the thought that victory was practically assured, and that they should soon repair the losses. In a second joint council of war, the question was debated whether Avaricum was to be burnt or defended. The Biturges went down on their knees and implored the representatives of the other tribes not to compel them to set fire with their own hands to a town that was almost the finest in Gaul, the chief defence and pride of their state. It could easily be held, they said, in view of its natural strength, for it was almost completely surrounded by river and marshes, in which there was only one narrow opening. Their petition was granted. Vercingetorix, though he opposed it at first, was at length prevailed upon by their entreaties and by the general sympathy felt for them, and a careful choice was made of officers to defend the town. Following Caesar's march by easy stages, Vercingetorix selected for his encampment a spot 16 miles from Avaricum, protected by marshes and forests. By an organised liaison service, he was informed hourly of events at Avaricum and transmitted his orders accordingly. He was constantly on the watch for parties, Roman parties, going out for forage or corn, and by attacking them when they were isolated, for they were obliged to go far afield, he inflicted heavy losses, although they tried everything they could to think to baffle him, setting out at irregular intervals and by different routes. Caesar encamped on the side of the town where there was a narrow gap in the marshes and watercourses surrounding it, and began to build a siege terrace, form lines of mantlets, and erect two towers upon the terrace, for the lie of the land made it impossible to invest the place. To maintain a supply of corn, he kept importuning the Boii and the Aedui, but the Aedui were lukewarm and gave little help, while the Boii, a small and feeble tribe, had only slender resources, which were quickly exhausted. Never mind what they're going to eat, I suppose. The troops were brought to such straits by the inability of the Boii to relieve them and the indifference of the Aedui, as well as by the burning of the granaries, that for several days they had no grain and saved themselves from starvation only by bringing in cattle from distant villages. Yet not a word were they heard to utter that was unworthy of Roman soldiers with successful campaigns to their credit. Indeed, when Caesar addressed the men of each legion at their work and told them that if they found their privations unbearable, he would abandon the siege, with one voice they begged him not to do so, saying that they had served under him for many years without suffering any humiliation or ever being forced to relinquish a task that they had set their hands to. They would feel it a humiliation to abandon the siege now, and would rather suffer any hardship than fail in avenging the Romans who had fallen victims to Gallic treachery at Cenobum. They said the same to their centurions and military tribunes, asking them to pass it on to Caesar. So there's a classic example of where the soldiers, the common soldiery, absolutely love Caesar. They seem to love him. They'll do anything for him. There's so many examples of this. It wasn't necessarily the case, or not as much the case, years ago when Caesar was first in command in Spain. Even at the very, very beginning of the Gaul campaigns, it wasn't necessarily the case. But by this point now, he's their boy, you know. They'll do anything for him. And as the years tick by, it becomes even more so. But we can see here now that they will follow Caesar to the ends of the earth. They really will do almost anything for him. Okay, so the story goes on. The siege towers had already been moved close to the wall when Caesar learnt from prisoners that Vercingetorix, having run out of forage, had moved nearer Avaricum, and had taken command in person of the cavalry and the light-armed infantry who regularly fought among the cavalry, in order to ambush the place where he expected our men would go the next day to forage. Accordingly, Caesar set out silently at midnight and reached the enemy's camp in the morning, but they received speedy warning of his approach from their patrols, hid their wagons and baggage in the densest part of the woods, and drew up all their forces on open rising ground. On hearing of this, Caesar at once ordered his men to pile their packs and get their arms ready. Once again, it's on. It's going to have a battle here. The hill that the enemy occupied had a gentle gradient at the bottom and was almost surmounted by a marsh, which was extremely difficult to negotiate, although only 50 feet wide. The Gauls had taken down the causeways leading over the marsh and, relying on the strength of their position, refused to budge from the hill. Formed up in tribal groups, they held all the fords and the thickets that bordered the marsh, determined, if the Romans tried to force a passage, to overpower them by running down to the attack while they were stuck fast in the mud. Awaiting us at such a distance, they looked as if they were prepared to fight a battle on more or less equal terms, but their position was so much stronger than ours that this show of courage was clearly a mere pretense. The legionaries were indignant at the enemy's daring to face them at such close range, and clamoured for the signal to attack. But Caesar pointed out how costly a victory would be in these conditions, how many brave men's lives must be sacrificed when they showed such steadfast loyalty and were willing to face any danger for his honour. He would be guilty of the grossest injustice if he did not consider their lives before his own interests. After addressing them in this way to alleviate their disappointment, he led them back to camp the same day and proceeded to complete his preparations for the siege of the town. End quote. So, it looked like a battle was going to be on, but Caesar canny Caesar, wily old Caesar, saw with his general's eye, his one of the greatest eyes, battlefield eyes there's ever been, saw that even Caesar, even the great Roman legions of the first century BC, this is an ask. This battlefield, the way this is set up, this is not a good idea. And that is brave in leadership terms. That's brave. When all your men expect you to attack, to be unafraid, to be accused of being a coward or something. That's good leadership. To make the right decision. It's a classic thing in all sorts of games and sports and conflicts and battles. And like in chess, someone will draw you out. Put a rook or a knight deep behind your line and expect you to react to it. And sometimes it's best just leave it there, walk away. You're going to damage yourself more by taking the bait, even though it seems the most obvious thing, even though it seems like it's the only thing to do. No, no, you don't have to. No, no, I'll wait. It's fine. It's fine. That's a trap. Okay, he goes on. On returning to his main body, Vercingetorix was accused of treachery for having moved his camp nearer the Romans, for going off with all the cavalry, and for leaving such a large army without anyone in supreme command. All this could not have happened by chance, they said, but must have been deliberately planned. Evidently, he would rather become king of Gaul by Caesar's favour than by the gift of his fellow countrymen. To these charges, Vercingetorix replied that he moved camp because he was short of forage, and they themselves had pressed him to do so. He went nearer the Romans because he had found a very favourable position, so well protected by nature that no defence works were required. Oh, one thing quickly to say here, in the earlier part of this chapter, which I didn't read, we were told that Vercingetorix was quite a harsh disciplinarian. If anyone did anything wrong in his army, it says he just tied them to a stake and cut them up, or cut their ears off, or put their eyes out for like sort of small misdemeanours, for relatively small offences. So Vercingetorix is not to be trifled with as a leader. And then Caesar puts words in his mouth again, and Vercingetorix is supposed to have said, "I knew that the cavalry would not be missed on this marshy ground, whereas it was very useful in the place to which I took it. I purposely did not delegate the command to anyone when I went away, for fear the person I chose might be induced by the enthusiasm of the rank and file to give battle, for I could see that that was what they all desired, because they were soft and incapable of prolonged exertion. If the arrival of the Romans during my absence was an accident, it was a stroke of luck for us. If it was the result of information conveyed by a traitor, you ought to be grateful to him for enabling you to see from your commanding position how weak are their forces and how contemptible is their cowardice, since they slunk back ignominiously to their camp without daring to fight. I have no need to obtain from Caesar by treachery the power that I can secure by victory, a victory already in my grasp, and to be shared by the whole Gallic people. You may take back the command you entrusted me with, if you imagine that you are conferring a favour on me, when in reality you owe your lives to me. To satisfy yourselves that what I say is true, hear what these Roman soldiers have to say." With these words, he brought forward some camp servants whom he had captured on a foraging expedition some days previously and had subjected to the tortures of chains and starvation. These he had carefully primed beforehand with the answers that they were to make when questioned. They said that they were legionaries and that the hunger and want they had suffered made them steal out of camp to see if they could find any corn or cattle in the fields. The whole army, they added, the whole Roman army, they added, was in the same plight. Every man was at the end of his strength and unfit for work, and their commander had decided to raise the siege in 3 days' time unless some progress was made. "That," cried Vercingetorix, "is what you owe to me, whom you charge with treachery. Thanks to me, without shedding a drop of your own blood, you see a great and victorious army almost destroyed by starvation, and when it is routed and retreats in disgrace, I have taken good care that no people should admit it into their territory." The whole concourse cheered and clashed their weapons, as the Gauls are accustomed to do when they approve of what a speaker says. Vercingetorix was a great leader, they declared, his loyalty above suspicion, and no one could conduct the campaign with greater skill. They determined to send into Avaricum 10,000 men picked from all the contingents, not wishing to entrust the national cause to the Bituriges alone, because they realised that if the Bituriges saved the town, the victory would be entirely theirs. To battle the extraordinary bravery of our troops, the Gauls resorted to all kinds of devices, for they are a most ingenious people, and very clever at borrowing and applying ideas suggested to them. They pulled aside our wall hooks with lassos, for example, and when they had made them fast, hauled them inside with windlasses. They made our terraces fall in by undermining, at which they were expert, because they have extensive iron mines in their country, and are thoroughly familiar with every kind of underground working. They had also equipped the whole circuit of the walls with towers, furnished with platforms, and protected by hides. They made frequent sorties by day and night, either to set fire to the terrace, or to attack our soldiers at work. As our towers were raised higher by the material added each day to the terrace, they increased the height of theirs correspondingly by inserting floors between the upright posts forming the framework. They countermined the subterranean galleries that we were digging towards the walls and prevented their continuation by throwing into them stakes sharpened and hardened in a fire, boiling pitch and very heavy stones. End quote. So, wow, that paints quite a picture, doesn't it? All sorts of sapping and counter-sapping, wall building, tower building, and counter-wall building and counter-tower building. It's quite a siege. It must have been quite a sight. Both sides determined that Avaricum was going to be a site of victory for them. For once, the Roman engineers actually came up against people that were prepared to at least try and match them like for like.
If you would like to see the full version of this premium video, please head over to lotuseaters.com and subscribe to gain full access to all of our premium content.